are listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Althea Billings. It's Earth Day, and today we're bringing you a very special show that we're calling Environmental Justice Changemakers Are Making It Happen. For the next hour and a half, I'll be interviewing Oregon nonprofit leaders from across the environmental issue, from saving salmon and pollinator habitat to green job training for Black youth and reducing food waste. Folks in our state are putting in the work at the intersection of climate, food, justice, and opportunity, and we're here to learn more about it. Let's start with the habitat, specifically salmon habitat. Longtime Pacific Northwesterners have certainly heard at one time or another the critical importance of this keystone species. Preserving salmon habitat, fixing salmon habitat, changing human-built infrastructure to better accommodate salmon, these are all common parts of that conversation. But the Wild Salmon Center employs a perhaps more novel approach. They seek out salmon strongholds, or existing salmon habitat that's already in decent shape, to focus their efforts on, fortifying and preserving what's already there. I spoke with Audie Paulus, the Senior Donor Relations Manager, and Tim Elder, Senior Manager of Habitat Restoration at Wild Salmon Center, to learn more about their efforts. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. Maybe we can start out with a little bit of background for folks who don't know. What is the Wild Salmon Center?
Yeah, so the Wild Salmon Center is an international conservation nonprofit. We're based in Portland, Oregon, and we focus on protecting what we call strongholds, which are the greatest remaining wild salmon watersheds across the Pacific Rim. And these strongholds are watersheds and rivers that support diverse and abundant populations of wild fish and wildlife.
Can you tell me a little bit about what each of your roles look like?
Yeah, so my role, so I work on the development team. So I work with all the programs across our regions to connect donors and activists with the work happening on the ground.
And I am a senior manager for habitat restoration in Oregon. So my job is about equally split between developing watershed scale plans for restoration. We call them strategic action plans. And I work with a variety of stakeholders, including state and federal agencies, tribal partners, local nonprofits, and a bunch of watershed councils. And we develop these watershed scale plans that are planning out maybe 20 or 30 years and developing goals and strategies to allow salmon in these populations to thrive.
Well, I'm sure, you know, folks who've spent some of their time, any amount of their time in the Pacific Northwest, have some idea of why protecting and preserving salmon is important. But I'd like to kind of address that specifically. What is the significance of salmon in Northwest ecosystems?
So generally speaking, if folks don't know, salmon are a keystone species, which means that they really are the lifeblood of the rivers and watersheds where they live across the Pacific. In watersheds near and far, they make these annual migrations that millions of these fish are moving from the ocean to the rivers where they were born. And during that migration, they're bringing with them one of the planet's largest natural transfers of life from sea to land. So, you know, in remote rivers and then rivers just outside Portland, you know, these fish are supporting species like bears, orcas, wolves, caddisflies, and they're also at the center of rural and indigenous communities around the coast. So really, when you zoom out and look at it, when you protect salmon, you're not just protecting wild fish, you're protecting forests, food, water, communities, and economies. So really, salmon are essential to protecting life in these watersheds around the Pacific.
Yeah, and I can build off of that a little bit. So in Oregon, we've seen that the last 150 years have had major landscape scale changes to rivers and streams, to the whole landscape. Effects from mining and logging, hydro development, building dikes and levees, all these sorts of actions have really just changed the way our rivers not only look, but how they function ecologically. And so a lot of the work that we do is trying to identify the effects of past, what we call legacy effects from those different types of resource extractions generally. And we are trying to identify long-term strategies that can ameliorate those issues. And in Oregon, you know, there's a long, long history of salmon just being a vital part of the First Nations that have been here for thousands of years, as well as Oregonians love fishing. So this is just part of our kind of built into our DNA in Oregon.
Well, yeah, off of that, what are some of the projects that Wild Salmon Center is focusing on in Oregon?
Generally, our focus in Oregon is around protecting, you know, forests and then freshwater rivers for wild fish and communities. And one of the main campaigns we're working on in the state is to get a habitat conservation plan passed for the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests, which if you've ever driven from Portland out to the coast, you've driven through that huge, huge temperate rainforest. And that's really critical habitat, not just for salmon, but a ton of different wildlife species. And right now, we have the potential to protect over half of that state forest. So that's over 300,000 acres in habitat conservation areas for the next 70 years. It's a kind of once in a generation opportunity to secure major protections for critical temperate rainforests to help slow climate change, fresh water for local communities, and incredible wild fish habitat. And that is a big campaign of ours right now. There's a big push to get that passed, and the timeline for that's kind of early 2025 is when that final decision will be made. And while this major campaign is happening right now to protect state forests, we're also seeing just a really exciting and historic moment for restoration across the state for rivers and wild fish. And since that's under Tim's purview, I think he could probably share some really exciting stuff that's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. So Adi touched on some of the major policy actions that we've been pursuing here, which are going to have, again, just massive positive effects for salmon populations, specifically up in those forests up north. A lot of the restoration work that I do focuses on specifically on coho salmon, which are listed as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. And we do a variety of actions. So we spend a lot of time trying to ensure that there is clean, cold water in the streams, which is increasingly difficult with climate change. We spend a lot of time developing these strategic action plans that a lot of the restoration actions that we do include things like adding large wood structures to streams. This really builds the habitat complexity, which salmon require for multiple life stages. We are trying to remove barriers. So a lot of our efforts are focused on removing fish passage barriers. And these can be anything from major dams to small dams and levees. We've got tide gates on the Oregon coast, perched culverts. So those are kind of our bread and butter restoration actions right there.
You touched on this a little bit, but Wild Salmon Center focuses its work on salmon strongholds, which differs from some other conservation strategies. Can you define that for me and kind of explain why it differs and why it's important?
Yeah, so, you know, we've seen in the history of our work, and really I think the history of conservation is it's very expensive and sometimes not very effective to try and protect places once they've passed the point of, you know, degradation. We've seen it in so many places, major rivers where we're pumping, you know, hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars into trying to restore salmon runs, and we're not seeing the results. So the approach that Wild Salmon Center has really taken is to look at where are the places around the Pacific that still have really intact habitat. Maybe there's some reaches of those rivers that need some restoration help to get them functioning at full capacity. Where are these watersheds where salmon populations have enough genetic diversity to be able to adapt to a changing climate? And where are we seeing that abundance that we need? And really looking at kind of the preventative medicine approach to conservation. So to get in before major projects have been approved, and really draw a line in the sand around these watersheds to make sure that they're protected today and into the future, because there are still really incredible rivers and watersheds that we have left. And to really focus on that proactive approach means that we're going to have these places now and into the future. And I think that's a really unique approach that Wild Salmon Center takes, and it's one that has been fairly successful for us.
And I can add just a little bit to that. I see the stronghold approach as being this, basically it's a build from strength.
Yeah.
Like, as Adi mentioned, we can spend a whole lot of money trying to bring a population that is not doing very well at all up to doing pretty well. Or we can spend less money in a wider geography, bringing populations that are doing pretty well up to really to this point where they're thriving. So our goal here, which is a little bit of a novel conservation strategy, I'm thinking back to my conservation biology class that I took as an undergrad, and this stronghold approach was never, I don't remember that at all being considered. But again, with relatively modest investments, we can really protect and restore these strongholds. And that gives us these launching pads. So as Adi mentioned, we can, from these strongholds, we can see kind of radiating out abundance and productivity of salmon. So it's a novel, but as Adi said, a very successful restoration strategy.
It's also new to me. I'll echo it wasn't something that I was aware of. And, you know, I grew up in Seattle, and there was every year there would be salmon hatching in the school that we got from the hatchery. And that was like part of the education, but not as a complete a picture as what the work that you guys do.
Yeah, it's interesting. Althea, I've participated in some of those egg to fry programs, they're oftentimes called, and those are oftentimes hatchery fish that are brought into schools, and it's a great opportunity to get kind of hands-on experience for school-age kids to see these developments. One of the things I do want to point out is Wild Salmon Center really focuses our efforts on wild salmon populations. And that's a little bit of an important distinction there, that the build from strength model is really looking at building up these wild populations. As we look ahead at our changing climate, wild populations really are our best bet for having the genetic diversity that's going to be required for these populations to adapt to these new and oftentimes novel environmental conditions.
Well, off of that, all of this work is happening amid a changing climate, as you mentioned. Over time, have the strategies that Wild Salmon Center has been employing, have those changed as a result?
That's a great question. I would say, you know, one of the key tenets of our work is really basing our policy and restoration priorities off of current science. And we have a whole science team here on staff that's really focused on looking at what are the environmental trends we're seeing that are impacting salmon across their range, and how should current science inform our conservation strategies to address, you know, the habitat, freshwater, and sort of management needs of these fish moving forward. I've only been at Wild Salmon Center for 9 years, which I guess for some is maybe a long time. but I think, you know, that's one thing that's really effective about the stronghold strategy is that it really does look at, okay, what are these main markers of, you know, where are these wild fish, where is there a lot of genetic diversity, where is that abundance, and what does the habitat look like in those watersheds that's allowing those fish to thrive, and how do we protect that and those fish moving forward so that they can adapt to this changing climate. So it's more adaptive.
In terms of like the direct restoration actions that we're doing, a lot of this federal funding that we've been applying for is directed towards salmon populations. But a lot of these federal funding opportunities come along with secondary goals, like how can we support human communities through these restoration actions as well. So we're really kind of adapting to this changing climate landscape through the actions that we're taking on the ground. So some of the things that we're doing, a lot of flood mitigation. Alfie, you and your listeners will probably know that as the climate is changing, one of the things that we're noticing is our snowpacks are melting earlier. And in the wintertime, that early snow melt is resulting in these really high winter flows. And those high winter flows are can be difficult for juvenile fish to deal with, but they're also causing, we're seeing increasing flooding in human communities. We're seeing these atmospheric rain events that is just bringing all this water that our infrastructure is not necessarily prepared to deal with. So as Wild Salmon Center is looking at how can we not only implement some of these projects that are going to be really beneficial to salmon populations, some of these restoration actions can also really benefit the human communities, like I said, by helping to attenuate some of the flooding. Floodplain reconnection is a really big, important thing. And so thinking about how we can increase floodplain connectivity for our salmon, but then thinking about how to make and retain safety for our human community as well.
I think you both touched on this next aspect I want to ask about, but what are those critical pieces of Habitat for Wild Salmon that you're looking for or that are going to be the focus of this kind of work?
So, I mean, some of the things that we're really looking at, I mean, juvenile salmon. So one of the things we look at when we go into a population and we're trying to assess what's going on, one of the things that we're seeing a lot is that juvenile salmon don't have some of the complexity in the river that they need. Some of the alterations that humans have made, they've basically made it so rivers stay really well contained inside their linear channel there. And so in addition to increasing that complexity in the stream, we're also trying to connect the river with its floodplain. And so by doing that, we allow these juvenile fish to get out of that main river corridor in the wintertime, as I mentioned, when those flows are really high, and it gives them basically a little rest stop. These floodplains are great areas for them to get some energy back. They can feed, and again, they can then hop back in the river and keep moving on their movement downstream.
Where do you see there being opportunities for more of this kind of work going forward?
A lot of our work in Oregon focuses on coho salmon. And coho salmon are listed as a threatened species, federally listed. And so the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has identified, along with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, some populations that are not doing as well as others, as well as some of these strongholds. So we've got our eye on several populations. The Umpqua River is a great example of a place where we'd love to get in. To work.
I'm told there's also more federal funding and grants and energy going into this kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, under the Biden administration, we're seeing, I mean, really across the country, huge investments from the Inflation Reduction Act and the infrastructure bills that were passed. That's just driving unprecedented levels of funding from the federal government into river restoration efforts. So, you know, one of the things that Wild Salmon Center has been focused on is how do we capture as much of that money for our community partners that are working on the ground to restore these watersheds? How are we capturing as much of that money as possible and driving it into groups and our local partners who really don't have access to fund the river restoration efforts that are needed to meet these goals to bring these populations to healthy levels.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about Wild Salmon Center, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, well, I would say We share a lot of our conservation updates on our social media channels. We also just work in incredibly beautiful places, so your feed will be full of just amazing rivers and wild fish and wildlife. So you can follow us on, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. But also if you visit our website, you can sign up for our email list, and we send kind of a once a month summary on all the work that we're doing, not just in Oregon, but across our geographies. And this month, as part of Earth Day Oregon, we're really talking about, you know, the work that's relevant to folks that live here in the state. So Tim's work doing restoration across the coast, our work to protect half of the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. And we're also running a drive right now to try and get people to join our Stronghold Guardian program, which is our monthly donor circle. And with that, you get lots of benefits, and you're really the first to know about, you know, what's happening on the ground, how to get involved, what meetings and kind of activist roles that you can take to really advance wild salmon conservation closest to you. So that's what I would say.
We are currently developing our strategic action plans in the Upper Rogue River, in the Coquille River Basin, and in the Tillamook Basin, as well as the Salette. And we have action plans that are completed in the Siuslaw River, the Elk River, and in the Halem River. And as I said, we are looking, we've got our eyes set on the South Umpqua River as a potential area to develop a strategic action plan, as well as the Nestucca and the New River Florist system.
Well, thank you guys so much. You have a good rest of your day. That was Audie Paulus and Tim Elder speaking with me about the Wild Salmon Center, focused on protecting existing salmon strongholds and fortifying them into the future. If you're just tuning in, this is KBOO's special Earth Day programming. I'm Althea Billings. This episode is called Environmental Justice Changemakers Are Making It Happen. We just heard from folks working across the North Pacific on salmon habitat, but now we're going to zoom in to Southern Oregon, the Rogue Valley to be specific. Saving the bees is a common enough slogan, but the bees in question don't even really scratch the surface of the pollinators that make a difference in our landscapes. That's where the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley comes in. They help educate folks of all ages on how they can create environments that are friendlier to native pollinators, from bees to flies, beetles, and moths. I spoke with Christina Lefevre, president at the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley, to learn more. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. So, to start out here, what is the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley?
Good question. We have been around now for a number of years. Our mission has changed in that time because as we looked out at our changing landscape, we realized that there is not enough conversation and knowledge about the importance that our native pollinators, wherever you are, but us here in the Rogue Valley and this amazing Klamath Siskiyou bioregion, how important our native pollinators are to where we live. And then related to that is the importance of our native plants, because you really can't have one without the other. And so we want to talk to people. We are talking to people about the native bees, not the honeybees so much, that came over from Europe back in the 1600s on ships. And so we really want to raise the awareness of how important these creatures are that many people don't even see or even know about, from native bees to butterflies, moths, beetles pollinate, some beetles pollinate, even there are some flies that pollinate, wasps, and hummingbirds in our area, bats in other areas, but we don't have pollinating bats here. So there are other creatures in other parts of the world, but right here in the Rogue Valley, we want people to understand that, because when you know who you live with, and you can make perhaps different decisions on land use and conservation and things like that. So there is no other organization that's really focused on that around here. There are so many wonderful environmental organizations in this area because of what we have. And so just getting that word out through schools or adult education or events, community events, participating, doing plant sales, getting seeds out the door. So our organization has grown because there is a need and there's a desire for people to get involved and do that one thing, even if it's only planting a native plant in their garden that they've never had before. Then they're starting to help restore our ecosystem. There was a big fire here, I'm sure you heard about it, in 2020, and it devastated acres and acres and acres and acres and so many homes. And so there's this huge need to restore the landscape. And the best way to do that, because of where we live, the best way to do that is through replanting as many native plants as we can in the riparian areas, on the mountain sides, based on what ecosystem that plant needs. Let's put those plants there. I don't have 100% native yard on my property where I live, but if I had known then, when I was putting in landscape plants, if I had known then, back in 2016, what I know now, my yard would look different. So that's really what we're all about, in not a very small nutshell.
Well, you mentioned some of the insects and creatures that act as pollinators, but I want to, let's define that specifically. What is a pollinator and why are they so important?
Yeah, good question. Because, people don't necessarily remember if they even learned it in school. So pollination is basically the act of reproduction of a plant, whether it's a grass or a tree. Both of those are generally wind pollinated. A lot of the conifers and the grasses pollinated by wind. Others, maybe you had blueberries for breakfast or cherries, or you go hiking and you see a beautiful, I don't know what you have up in Portland, a shooting star or some of the different plants, even, an aster in your garden, a beautiful aster, which is a native plant. The way those plants reproduce is just like many other organisms in the world. You have the sperm or the pollen, in this case, carrying organism, part of the organism, I should say. And then there's the ovary. And so the pollen, in this case, has to get into a part of the plant that can turn into a seed, so it gets fertilized. So then the seed happens, and then we either eat the seed or we eat the fruit, or the seed falls on the ground and it grows another plant. So it's not completely true. About 85% of the world's flowering plants depend on pollination for reproduction. And so many of the reasons that we love to look at a garden is because those plants are pollinated by creatures that fly around. Fruit and vegetables, those are often people think of those as being pollinated by honeybees, but actually more and more information is coming out that all these other pollinators have a lot to do with our food system, not just the pretty flowers on the mountainside. So getting people to understand that, and then understanding, okay, well, if I want to continue to have that pretty landscape or that food on my table, then I need to take care of these other creatures that live here. So pollination is basically a way to fertilize plants so that we can have more of them.
Off of that, what are some of the things that are required to make a pollinator-friendly landscape?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So just like people, we need a place to sleep. We need a place to walk around without fear of, harm. We need food. So that's the same thing. So these pollinators live in different ecosystems. They have different life cycles, but basically they need a habitat where they can live out their very short lives and be safe, not have pesticides sprayed in their community, have a place either in the ground or in the hole of a tree, under the leaves. So where do they live? Well, if you know where they live, then you can sort of keep an area in your yard that's for them. Obviously, we're humans. We have to have sidewalks. We have to have driveways. Well, I guess we do. You know, you have to have paths that you can walk because you're not going to fall, trip over things. That's totally understandable. But if we have plants that are able to support them as habitat, that's one step. The second step is, or areas, I should say, it's not just plants. Plants are areas that they can support where they live. But then they have to have food. So a big component of a pollinator garden is having not only flowers that gives them the pollen and the nectar throughout the year for those different pollinators that come out and they're in the environment at that time of the year. But also moths and butterflies have caterpillars. I assume most people know that. Well, caterpillars don't eat pollen and nectar. They eat plants. If you're going to have butterflies and moths flying around, you have to have caterpillars. And the only way you can have caterpillars is if you have the native plants that that particular species eats. Everyone knows about the monarch and the milkweed. There's a lot of other plant Lepidoptera relationships in the caterpillar stage. My favorite story is violets and fritillaries. The caterpillars and fritillaries have to eat native violets. No native violets, no fritillaries. So if people start to understand these connections, so you have to have the flowers that bloom throughout the year that can provide pollen and nectar. There's even specialist bees I'm learning in my journey, that there are bees that depend on the pollen of a certain plant to feed their babies. If there's not that in the landscape, then there's not going to be that particular species of bees. I mentioned there's 750 species of bees. I mean, that's just mind-boggling to think that. That's just a corner of it. And being able to recognize something that maybe you didn't know before, it always helps me feel grounded. Oh, I know what that plant is. Oh, I know what that bug is. And I think that's something that more people could do. And if we knew, like I said, if we knew who else lives with us and what we can do to make that a better home for them, even if we don't see them. Weed fabric is an example that is a ubiquitous thing that people use in their landscape planting because, oh, I won't have weeds. Well, first off, that's a fallacy. Just give it a year or two and you're going to have weeds and you're going to wish you hadn't put that weed fabric down. Not only that, but it's going to be in that environment forever. But then if you think of it as a pollinator garden, it isn't. Since 70% of the bees nest in the ground, you will not have any native bees nesting in your landscape if you have weed fabric in that area. They can't get there. And then it actually changes the exchange of air and moisture and all sorts of things. So you no longer have a pollinator garden if you have weed fabric in that area. So you need a safe place. You need a place for them to live, either in the ground or in a tree or wherever, under the leaves. You need food all year long. Many of those 750 species of bees come out at different times of the year. So you can have, most people have heard of the mason bees. You have mason bees in the springtime, but you have leafcutter bees that come out in the adult stage in the fall or late summer. Where are they the rest of the time? Well, they're in their larval stage in their nest where their mama laid them about a year ago. They stay, this is mind-boggling to think that a bee is an adult. This is not all bees. There's always exceptions. A lot of the bees, 6 weeks-ish, and the rest of the time, they're either in their egg or their larva stage or the pupa stage, underground or in a crevice, and we just don't see them. So we only think of the bee for that 6 weeks of time. There are exceptions, which I don't probably need to get into. But isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. I mean, and to understand, you know, the diversity of bees, because I think so much of even the idea of saving the bees is really informed by by honeybees and how they tend to operate.
Correct. That is correct. Because that's, you know, our Western society. The honeybee is, you know, a giver of honey. They provide other things like propolis. And they're beautiful. They're fun. It's an amazing way of, you know, interacting with another organism. But there are a lot of honeybees. And one could add that to the list of things that are impacting our native pollinators. Our world is getting smaller and smaller as we get more and more people, and so that means the environment where these creatures live is getting smaller and smaller. And it's a fact of life that if there's too many of whatever and the resources are getting smaller and smaller, somebody's going to be impacted. And there's plenty of stories out there where in a number of cases, the honeybees are actually, the numbers of honeybees, if there's a lot of them, are actually impacting the native bee species, especially when there's not enough forage. What's forage? Forage is flowering plants that the bees, no matter what species, are able to interact with. So that's another reason, you know, people, if you can plant the gardens, and you don't even have to think about it as a garden like a photograph, you know, okay, I planted my garden, I've taken my photo, I'm done. It's going to look gorgeous all the time. A pollinator garden, in my mind, but I have a little bit different aesthetics than other people. A pollinator garden, in my mind, changes. So, especially when you're doing, learning about native plants, they change. They don't look pretty all the time. I'll be the first to admit it. And so I love the pollinator gardens where they change. Maybe that plant dies, but it leaves lots of seeds in the ground, and all of a sudden you have that same plant, but it's not the same plant. You have the same species, and it's over there now. And so the plant, the garden actually moves around as the plants find different places. They expand. So rather than keeping that one plant in that one little shape right there, you end up with multiples all in that area, or they move around and they become part of the garden, and it's in a different way that you never imagined. And I bet it's going to be better than what you imagined.
What happens when a landscape isn't pollinator friendly? Like, what are the kind of consequences that happen as a result?
Yeah, well, we are going to start losing our pollinators, right? And we're going to start losing our landscape. The landscape industry has the ability to bring in plants that are from other parts of the world. And so as anyone, I'm sure this is true no matter where you live, as you drive through a city, you're going to see so many plants that have come from Europe or Asia or other places. And as beautiful as they are, they serve very little into that cycle of life that our pollinators and our birds need, and other creatures. That's one thing that I forgot to mention, that one of the reasons that there's been a big decline in our bird populations over time is because there isn't enough to eat, and most species of birds, not all of them, use the caterpillar as a major food source. So if you have less caterpillars, then you're going to have less birds. So it's a pretty big implication when you start losing something that's so tiny but so part of the food chain. So thinking about how we can interact negatively or positively is something to think about as we look at this pollination and food source situation.
Yeah. Well, when you're educating people about pollinators and how they can change their habits and practices to better accommodate them, do you encounter any misconceptions that people have?
Most people had never heard of more than 10 bees. And, you know, so we have a wonderful poster that we use often from Backyard Bees of North America. And it shows maybe about 125 species. And people are blown away that there's that much diversity of bees just in this continent. So most people, that's a misconception. Most people have no idea how many species of bees there are. One of the species, the Perdida, also known as the fairy bee, is so small that you can't even see it hardly with your naked eye. And that's a bee. So I think that's an easy misconception. People think honeybee is the bee pollinator, and, you know, just ask anybody from Oregon Bee Project and they'll tell you that that is totally not true. People don't necessarily know how many species of moths and butterflies there are. You know, weave fabric is a good thing. So to me, that's a misconception. They don't realize the diversity of the plants and how intertwined they are with the pollinators and other creatures as well. What's the importance of grasses, of native grasses? You know, a grass is a grass is a grass. I have trouble with grasses. I am not a grass person, but I do know that our native bunch grasses are food for butterflies. So we need native grasses in the landscape. Another misconception is that native plants will burn, and actually a lot of them are fire adapted. And so I think planting the native grasses, it's been proven that they actually will not burn as much as some of the non-native grasses that are out there. So I think there are misconceptions about how people look at some of these native plants. With trees, we need more trees. Wood chips aren't necessary. Arborist wood chips are better than bark. What's bark? You know, so there's lots of nuances to all of this.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I would say, of course, the website. So our website is pollinatorprojectroguevalley.org. You should be able to find that easily enough. We also have a pretty active Facebook page right now because we're posting about not only the Earth Day Oregon events, but we have a plant sale coming up. There's Earth Day events happening. So you can find us on Facebook, on Instagram as well. Please check out our resources page. I still think that needs work on the website, but at least it's there. We have an events page that also needs to be updated. But you can get started there to learn more about us. We are a primarily volunteer organization at the moment, but we have aspirations to grow. And any donation of any size is greatly appreciated, because having the support of the community, not only with volunteers, but also financial contributions, that's what allows us to keep going. And so we really do appreciate it. We have, big dreams, and people can help get the word out about our native pollinators and our native plants.
If folks have been listening to this and, you know, are hearing about all the native pollinators and these action items that they can take to try to create a more pollinator-friendly landscape, if they're to walk away with, like, one action item, what would you recommend?
Learn about the plants and the pollinators that are local to your area. You would have some species that are similar to southern Oregon, and there would be others that aren't. Your climate is different up there. Yours is more wet, I presume, and ours is more dry for the most part. So start learning. Check out the Native Plant Society of your region. Do some Googling, pay attention to the details. Learn genus and species. What do those two words mean? So, like, I was just talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about putting in some plants in this particular area, and he sent me a list. And so cottonwood is on there. Okay, well, cottonwood's a native plant, but I looked at the species. So I saw the genus and I saw the species. Well, that particular cottonwood he was talking about was not local. It came from some other country. So pay attention and look at the details, and then think about how that can impact where you live.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me, and thank you for your work at Pollinator Project Rogue Valley.
Well, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
That was Christina Lefevre, president of the Pollinator Project Rogue Valley, speaking with me about her organization and their efforts to protect pollinators and educate people about being better neighbors to these important species. One thing that struck me about both the conversation with Christina and the one that I had earlier with the folks from Wild Salmon Center is how the predominant narrative about what action is needed on their respective topics, pollinators and salmon, aren't necessarily based on what is the most comprehensive and effective solutions to the problems that humans have caused. It's not just saving the honeybee that's important to plant life. Honeybees came from Europe. Honeybees and local bees, like the ones Christina described, are both impacted by pesticide use and environmental factors, but there's an added complexity to the simple phrase, save the bees. Similarly, with Wild Salmon Center, they're not focused on hatcheries or trying to take a majorly human-manipulated stream system back to its days of being a salmon spawning area, but instead preserving what already exists in our environment. Looking at the climate crisis and the need for quick action to stop catastrophe, it's important to recognize work that has that in mind. We've got more environmental justice changemaker interviews coming your way shortly. This is KBOO Community Radio. It's Earth Day, and I'm Althea Billings. Now, we're going to pivot to environmental justice work that's being done local to the Portland area. A just transition to green fuels, jobs, and a green economy is on everyone's lips. And it means making sure that communities that have been marginalized by development in the past have a seat at the table. The Blueprint Foundation is bringing these opportunities to Black youth in the Portland metro area. They engage students and young adults in culturally specific experiences in environmental work and green career development aimed at eliminating the opportunity gap for Black youth. I spoke with Jason Stroman, the program director at the Blueprint Foundation, to learn more. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to sit down with us. So to start out here, what is the Blueprint Foundation?
So the Blueprint Foundation is a local nonprofit that is kind of the evolution of a mentoring program that my fraternity brothers and I started back in 2010 in direct response to some pretty abysmal census statistics that came out that year with regards to graduation rates for the young men in our community. And so we had just started a local chapter and looking at ways to make impact. And that just seemed like a logical starting point. And so as a organization of professional Black men, we partnered with another program that was already operating over at Roosevelt High School, which is where the lowest graduation rates were at the time, and created an affinity group specifically for Black male high school students who were already identified as the most at risk for not completing high school. And so we developed that program. We came in every couple of weeks. We, you know, exposed them to different professionals and different careers, also did some cultural enrichment, financial literacy, took them on outings, and really just found that by, you know, creating that network of support and exposure, it really increased their chance of, you know, retaining in school and being successful. And so in those first 5 years, we only had one student that didn't graduate. And even that was kind of a fluke. He started working to support his girlfriend at the time. And so, you know, that 95% versus the 53% graduation rates at the time showed that it was having an impact, but we were still limited what we could do kind of out of pocket. And so we did some research, realized that if we started a 501c3, we could go after some federal funding that was available at the time and really scale up and build a more robust program. And so that's what we did. We partnered with Dr. Daron Coles, who helped us through that process, and then we convinced him to stay on as our executive director. And we built a mentoring program that was more discipline-specific around career exposure, specifically in the environmental field, because we realized through our research that was a big area. One, that the administration at the time was investing in heavily because they knew it was the future and it was in desperate need of diversification, but also because it was a unique opportunity to really reconnect our youth and community to nature in a way. And, you know, we're in the Northwest. We have the most beautiful mm-hmm. outdoor resources and scenery as anywhere in the world. But the irony is that a lot of folks in our community have been disconnected from that or severed from that through, you know, a laundry list of trauma and reasons. And so give us a unique opportunity to help our youth kind of reestablish and reconnect and establish healthy relationships with nature while also getting exposed and learning about potential careers in the green sector, which is just a huge opportunity for economic empowerment, which at the end of the day is what our communities need to kind of break cycles of poverty and break, interrupt violence and all the things that are plaguing our communities. And so that's what we did. We built this program up around environmental science, environmental education, as well as environmental justice, exposing them to issues that were disproportionately affecting our communities, and then giving the opportunity to be part of the solutions and mitigating those impacts. And so our kids are out pretty much every weekend or three times a week or a month at least, engaging in stewardship, planting trees to increase tree canopy or removing invasive species, restoring habitat, or sometimes just, exploring, going on hikes in different areas that they probably would never have access to on their own, or even just exploring the places near them in their neighborhoods. We partner with a lot of local nonprofits and watershed councils to engage students near where they live so that they have a sense of investment and ownership in what they do. We do neighborhood plantings with Friends of Trees and with Columbia Sioux Watershed, Johnson Creek Watershed. We're part of several coalitions that are doing work, like in the Lee's Botanical Garden, back 5 acres, restoring that to create the ultimate outdoor classroom. And then, we try to give the students opportunities to not only get exposure and learn, but then turn around and teach what they've learned and be part of that process as well, of empowering their community while also building their personal skills and building their confidence, building community. In a place like Portland that's been so heavily gentrified, the opportunity for students to spend a Saturday with 20 other Black kids and adult mentors that look like them, that, can relate to their experience, is a really unique and special thing. And so we don't take that for granted. We try to, really foster that and be unapologetic about that, because it is a unique opportunity in a city like this. And so combining all those things just really gives our kids a unique experience that they value and help build a sense of community while also doing something they can feel good about.
Very cool. Well, I understand that the Blueprint Foundation uses a WISE model as kind of the basis for a lot of what you guys do. Can you break down, what that looks like?
Sure. So our WISE model is an acronym. So the first step is to witness. So that's just the exposure, getting kids out, getting them in spaces that they might not normally get exposure to witness all the wonder of nature around them, witness what a healthy ecosystem looks like, witness what folks who look like them in these careers look like and what their path look like. Witnessing first, and then investigating, engaging in water quality monitoring or air quality monitoring, or, doing those construction site tours and learning about how different people got into those trades. And then the S is solve, being part of the solutions, actually getting hands in the dirt, planting trees to, increase tree canopy, or, removing non-native species to create healthy habitats, and restoring trails with parks or other partners to, improve areas for everyone. And so, and then lastly, like I mentioned earlier, educate, like taking what they've learned and then turning around and passing that down, whether it's to younger students, which is really impactful, because we know through research and just our own observation that students engage and learn with material in a different way when they're learning from people that they look like them or that can relate to. And so that's a really important component. It also helps codify their learning, build their confidence, and just being an ambassador for not just the program, but for their community, and educating their community members on issues that they might not otherwise know about or have exposure to, but that they will be much more receptive to from members of their own community, especially the youth. And so, witness, investigate, solve, and then educate. It's kind of a full circle model that we've applied to our programming for our middle and high school age youth, and really for also for our workforce development, young adult programs as well.
Yeah, I like that closing the loop aspect of it. That's very cool. What are some of the recent projects that the Blueprint Foundation has been working on?
Wow.
That might be a laundry list. I don't mean to overwhelm.
No, that's fine. Like I said, we being a smaller organization, we've really relied heavily on our collaborations and been very intentional about who we partner with. And so some of those that have been going well, we have a what's called a Tappan Roots internship program specifically for Black identified high school students to bring them together as a cohort of about 16 to 20 high school students from all over the city who, you know, engage in monthly symposiums with the different partners, focus on different areas, whether it's learning about the history of local leaders in the environmental movement or learning financial literacy. They'll learn 1 month, or learning, you know, how to engage with youth, because then they will then have full-time employment in the summer with one of the partners as part of the internship. And so it's a really cool deal, a great way for them to not only earn money, but get a lot of knowledge and history locally about folks working in this sector. And then the E part, the educate, getting to turn around and, you know, either be a camp guide for the summer or, you know, working with us, working with our youth and helping plan activities and execute those. And so we're in our third year of that, and that's been really rewarding for all the students that have participated in that. Most of them come back and work multiple years with the organizations because they enjoy it so much. So that's just one program. We also have a partnership with the World Salmon Council for several years, and we're looking to ramp that up this year and increase engagement with schools. So they provide Salmon Watch field trips in the fall, which takes students actually out creekside, about an hour out of the city usually, and learn about salmon habitat during the actual spawning season. So they usually get to see, if you time it right, get to see salmon spawning and returning for that. And again, it's a different type of learning when the kids can actually see hands-on what's happening and see the habitat and see the impacts of why water quality is so important and what creates a healthy ecosystem in a riparian zone and you know, learning about macroinvertebrates and how those are indicators of a healthy stream and just getting boots on it in the water. And so it's a really immersive experience. And so our students for years have participated as student educators where they learn about the stuff and then turn around and help lead those stations during field trips. And I got to tell you, for your average fourth grader, you know, a high school student is like a rock star. And so They just have a ball on those field trips. Our kids really enjoy that feeling of getting to kind of be the leader and be the hero. Again, it you know, solidifies what they're learning. They feel confident becoming experts at something, but also just building their leadership and their confidence and, you know, things that are going to apply everywhere they go, being able to speak in front of people and So, yeah, that's been a really also a rewarding partnership that we're just continuing to grow, making sure that we go out and engage the schools to participate in that program that could really benefit the most, the schools with the diverse populations. Basically, again, one of the impetus is to have representation for those students at an early age to see themselves reflected as experts at something and as, you know, teachers and educators. And so it's a really powerful thing to witness when it's in action. And so we definitely want to keep that going and kind of bolster that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned, right, starting in 2015, it's certainly had an impact, like you were saying, about the graduation rate. But for folks who have been in it the past couple of years, like you've been saying about, what is the impact that that has on kids to be involved in that way? You know, now that they're, you know, this has been around for a while, starting early and following it all the way through.
Yeah, it's great you mentioned that. We're actually at that point now where we're actually seeing, or this last year, we've actually had students that have been in the program since their freshman year of high school, graduated, been in college for a couple of years, and have actually transitioned into becoming mentors themselves, which is like the ultimate realization of the dream, right? And so we have a couple young mentors that are veteran students who are the best mentors for kids coming behind them because they can relate the most. They know exactly what those kids are going through. Those kids know them or know their families or know that like everything they're saying is authentic and real because They've seen them go through the process. And to see those kids, you know, leading and teaching with confidence, it just resonates different than like us, or, you know, us old folks talking at them or trying to convince them this something is cool. Like when they see their peers that are 4 or 5 years older, like doing the work and enjoying it and loving it and enthusiastic about it, it just hits differently. And so that's the ultimate actualization that we're actually getting to enjoy and witness now, is seeing folks come full circle and, you know, not just giving back, but doing it, you know, with enthusiasm and with with a heart for the community and for the kids coming up behind them. And so that's been a gift and a joy to witness over the last couple of years. And then, yeah, just, you know, we're at a phase where we've gotten a lot of exposure and a lot of folks seeking us out. And like I said, younger students wanting to get involved. And even though the original curriculum was designed more for high school and getting folks ready for the workforce, we've tried to accommodate the younger demographic by engaging in more like mindfulness and more tools that are going to help them even get through middle and high school, because we know it's rough. I mean, the pandemic was really rough. Parents saw it firsthand. Like, it was a tough thing for a lot of kids to deal with, and a lot of them haven't readjusted yet. But one thing we did learn, that nature-based learning and being outdoors was healthy for everyone, something that everyone needs more of. And so, you know, just really leaning into that, providing as many opportunities for kids to be out and enjoying nature and engaging and learning in a different type of way that's more natural for us culturally, as well as just from a health standpoint, really leaning into the health benefits of that and recognizing that, you know, kids are out planting trees, smiling, getting, you know, sun and fresh air. They're not engaging in destructive or counterproductive behaviors and so on.
Right. You've touched on this in many ways in this discussion, but let's address it specifically. Why is it so important to get Black identified youth involved in environmental exploration and green workforce development?
Well, a couple of reasons. For one, it's just part of our heritage and culture. You know, we partner in our work with a lot of local indigenous leaders because, you know, for me, there's so many parallels between our cultural ancestral rights and traditions as indigenous knowledge and ways of thinking and doing when it comes to the relational worldview and, you know, having, you know, engaging with nature with reciprocity and with a certain level of respect and reverence and stewardship. And, you know, it's something that we should all embrace, you know, for the benefit of everyone. But for our students, it's a way to reconnect to their roots and their ancestry and their culture. But it's also just, you know, a way to have the skills to have sovereignty and like, have control over your own food sources, to have control. Like when the pandemic hit, we challenged and taught kids how to grow food at home. And several of them were successful at doing so. You know, it's important for our kids to learn about, you know, food systems and how those things are managed and how, you know, how unfortunately they've been denied access to healthy food systems, and that has resulted in generations of disproportionate disease like diabetes, like heart disease, and why those rates are so high in our communities is because, you know, we've been denied, you know, or we've been severed from how we've always before, you know, America been able to raise and engage in healthy consumption. And so a lot of it's just getting back to that, getting back to our roots. A lot of it's just simply for health, physical and mental health. And to my earlier point, it's a big chunk of the economy.
Right.
Everything is going green, whether it's construction, whether it's, you know, agriculture, whether it's systems, whether it's transportation, like regardless, whether you want to be a teacher, you know, whatever you want to do, you have to have some knowledge of sustainability and some kind of awareness of that. And so this just kind of helps build a framework and a mindset for our students to be aware of that, so that regardless of what they want to pursue, they can do it in a responsible way and in an informed way. We also, you know, with our adults, we're also priming them to, as adults, to be more engaged in advocacy and policy and being aware of, you know, the need for having representation at those tables and in those spaces to make sure that when decisions are being made that impact our community, we have representation there to have a voice at those tables. And so, you know, we have students that are on boards because they recognize that importance, because they've seen the example and the mentors that they have and understand that that's what you do when you care and when you know that issues need to be addressed on multiple levels.
Yeah. What do you wish people knew about the Blueprint Foundation? Any misconceptions or misunderstandings out there?
Yeah, I will say this because it came up recently. you know, we are a culturally specific organization. We were founded by a group of Black professional men to address issues facing Black youth, Black identified youth. And so that's always been our focus. And we've been unapologetic about that. But, you know, because the way our society is set up, there's always, whether it's conscious or biased or unbiased, there's always just this innate pushback or resistance to Black kids having something that's just for them. And so sometimes with people like, why do you only work with Black youth? Which is not true, by the way. We've had, you know, Asian and Latino youth. We've had youth from all backgrounds, but typically those youth are directly referred by Black identified youth that come from the same communities or situations. But the reality is there are issues that are specifically impacting us disproportionately. And so the solutions and our impact relies on, one, creating that affinity space and creating that community that allows kids to, you know, have these experiences in a safe and affirming way. And so I guess what I would want people to know is that the value in that outweighs the need to be all inclusive all the time. Like, it's okay for these kids to have spaces that are just for them.
Well, if our listeners are interested in learning more about the work that you do, what's the best way for them to do that? Are there ways that you want people to engage at this point?
We have a website that has a contact us box in it. Those come directly to our communications team. I think my information is on there. We also have an Instagram page that has gotten a huge facelift thanks to our program coordinator, Bria Beal. And they've done an amazing job at, like, just increasing the content. And our new development person, Bianca. And so our Instagram page is like 100 times more active and flowing with information now. And so that's probably the best place to engage as far as knowing what's going on, because that's kept up in real time. That's that advertises a lot of those workforce development programs I mentioned, as well as like giving visual representation of what we're doing with the youth out every week. It's a great place. You know, we also.
That was Jason Stroman, Program Director at the Blueprint Foundation, speaking with me about the organization, which aims to connect Black youth in the Portland metro area with culturally specific experiences in environmental restoration, green career development, and more. You're tuned in to KBOO's special Earth Day programming. I'm Althea Billings. This episode is called Environmental Justice Changemakers Are Making It Happen. We're continuing to hear from environmental nonprofit leaders in the Portland area. Have you ever wondered where the produce at the grocery store goes if no one buys it? Or what if a restaurant makes too many portions to sell in one night? There's a significant mismatch in where our food goes. 40% of the food that's produced in the U.S. is never eaten, but hunger persists in our communities. That's where Urban Gleaners tries to bridge the gap. They take that food that's still good and connect it to people who need it. I spoke to Urban Gleaners Executive Director Nico Norden to learn more. Welcome to the show, Nico.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. So for those of us uninitiated, what is Urban Gleaners?
So Urban Gleaners is a food rescue organization. We rescue food from grocery stores, community cafeterias, corporate cafeterias, college campuses, and we redistribute that food at 42 different free food markets in the Portland area. All of our food is free to anyone who would like it. We don't ask for any proof of poverty, proof of ID to access our food.
How did this kind of work get started? It's something I've always wondered about, where things go at the end of the day.
Yeah, so we started 18 years ago. Our founder, Tracy Ozerin, heard about a lady who was doing something kind of similar to this model, and she just immediately wanted to find something in Portland that was doing that so she could get involved. And there ended up not really being anything in the Portland area that was going and gleaning food urbanly. Gleaning is technically kind of a biblical term where you used to go out the end of the harvest into the crops and you'd like take what was ever left over and give it to people who were in need. So urban gleaning is a bit different. It's going to grocery stores and you know, different places like that, wholesale distributors, and taking food that they were going to throw away. There's a crazy statistic. It's like 40% of the food that's produced in the United States is thrown away. It's never seen a plate or a person. It's pretty wild that that 40% could feed everyone in the United States three times over. So there's all this waste and there's all this need, and Urban Gleaners is really just kind of providing a connection between the excess to the access.
Could we walk through the entire lifespan of this food that we're talking about, that you're sharing with the community?
Yeah, so our process, we operate 7 days a week. We have a fleet of 6 vans, and we go to the grocery stores, for instance, and we go into the receiving area, and they've pulled off items that maybe are near date, maybe the box is a little bit damaged, or the can was dented in a space that's like a safe dent but just doesn't look good to a customer who may be wanting to spend money. Anything that, like a produce item that's like got a banana that was split off, something like that. So we go in and we collect all of that food that's, you know, it's all delicious, it's all fresh, it's really, really great quality produce, really great quality canned and state fresh shelf-stable goods. We collect that food and we bring it back to our warehouse, where we sort through everything and make sure that there's nothing moldy or nothing like kind of too far past gone on its lifespan. And then we organize all that food and we sort it. And then all 7 days of the week, we take it out to our markets that operate Sunday through Saturday.
And so what are those markets like?
Yeah, they're really a cool experience. We have 20 of our markets that are actually public facing. You can find them on our website at urbangleaners.org in the free food market section. All of those markets operate a little bit differently. Some of them are in schools. There's some in community complexes or housing centers. And then we have a couple that operate in parks. We operate the park ones ourselves, the Mount Scott on Tuesdays, Lentz Park on Thursdays, and Woodlawn Park on Saturdays. They're a really amazing community event. You can come to the park. You arrive like 15 minutes early. We hand out numbers, so it's a little bit more equitable. Some people, you know, were trying to get there like 3 hours early to get a spot in line, and not everyone has the ability or access to be able to do something like that. So we went into a raffle system. You get to go to the park and get your number, and then the markets are all set up shopping style. We like to give people choice. We believe that choice, number one, reduces food waste, and it also just provides for a better experience. You know, instead of being handed a box of something, maybe you have an allergy, or maybe there's just something that you don't like in that box, you're going to probably throw it away and not use it, or maybe not even know how to use it properly. So we think that choice is super important and like a really distinguishing fact about our model of market. So you get to go through and just grocery shop for whatever it is you need in your household.
How does it differ from other models or cities or places where this kind of thing's going on?
Yeah, it's different, and there's, you know, a lot of different things in different cities. Some different counties or different areas are making laws stricter about like what can be thrown away and what can be composted, and that, you know, in San Diego, for instance, it's legally required that every grocery store partners with a nonprofit foundation to give their food to, or a food bank or a food pantry. We don't have those type of laws here in Portland, but we are, you know, there's some work in the food scraps laws that are kind of coming in place in Metro. So it's pretty great. We get to connect with these grocery stores who maybe didn't know that there was even an option, or these restaurants that didn't know that there was an option out there to, like, you know, take this food that they just don't have a use for, whatever it may be, wherever it's at in that lifespan, and connect it with us. And, you know, most of our food comes from Whole Foods, New Seasons, Zupan's, Trader Joe's. We have like really great high quality produce and prepared foods and really great desserts and bread. And we just have a full variety. It's a very large selection of items, as opposed to just some shelf stable stuff or some high calorie dense items that you can sometimes find at other places.
What does it take for a restaurant or a grocery store or any of these other sources that you mentioned? What does it take to become a partner? Are there certain things that you look for?
Honestly, all they have to do is reach out. We have a fleet of 6 vans, so we are out all days of the week, and we're going out and we're collecting things. So just give us a call and we'll come by and pick it up. We also have volunteers who take their own cars and drive out and get the kind of the smaller donations, that maybe a van isn't like the most amazing thing to take out because it's just like too much space, you know, to go pick up something that's like maybe just a couple pounds of food. But we want it all. We'll take anything and everything. And we do. Like I kind of mentioned earlier, we do sort through everything too. You know, sometimes we get stuff that's just moldy or it's too far past its date. If it's dairy, we work with a network of pig farmers in town, and they come and they pick up all of our food that we actually can't give to people. We have a tiny little compost can in our warehouse, which is pretty amazing because we do over 20,000 pounds of food in and out of our warehouse every week. And the rest of that food, we around like 10% of the food we get over the year is unusable food, and we donate all of that food to the pig farmers so the pigs get to eat.
Well, that kind of goes to one of the things I wanted to ask was, how do you quantify the success of your work? And like pounds is one way to think about it.
Yeah, that's like typically the way food organizations talk about success. It's in poundage. We did almost 1.2 million pounds taken in, and then almost like 1.1-ish going out. I feel like we like to say that we also quantify success as just like one person who didn't have food, now they were able to get access to food. We really pride ourselves on the style of market that we offer people. You know, there's abundance and there's choice and there's dignity involved as opposed to just getting a handout and expected to be thankful for it. We just really, really think that our market styles are just, you know, it's a fun place to go. It's not like a sad experience. It's like a great place to go and grocery shop.
Well, Urban Gleaner's work addresses two issues, right? We talked a little bit about the environmental impact of food waste, but also there's this hunger component. How do those kind of interplay together?
Yeah. You know, we've been saying this new thing of like we're kind of connecting this excess and access. A lot of people like to say, you know, the connecting point between like waste and want. It feels like a little bit dark when you say it that way. You know, it's food is a bit is healthcare. It's a basic human right. There's just so much abundance in food and overproduction out there, and we kind of just see ourselves as a like the connecting point between that. We're kind of like a distributor, almost just like going and grabbing something in one place and taking it to another and making sure that, you know, it doesn't get wasted.
Who are the people that you're working to serve in these markets?
Yeah, I mean, they really range. They can be, you know, we saw over the last couple years, especially with COVID, that threshold line of like, you know, people who never had to ask for help before. Now, all of a sudden, you know, maybe they lost their job, or maybe someone in the household lost their job, or, you know, things are just getting more expensive and they were always fine. And now it's like things are just getting a little bit more challenging, like having to make a decision between, you know, paying for maybe a medical bill that month or keeping the power on. It's people are getting in these positions that they never were in before. We saw a really, you know, there was all this extra SNAP benefits that happened during COVID. And then last March, they ended all those benefits. And so people just saw their spending power slashed through that. We were getting calls at the end of that when that period happened of just people looking for help and looking for access. We don't ask any questions. We try to lower the barrier as much as possible. To us, this is food, you know, that was going to incorrectly go into the landfill. We just want to make sure it gets used up. So anyone and everyone is welcome and at our public sites to come in and grocery shop and get the food.
You mentioned that San Diego has a law that grocery stores have to partner with a nonprofit to try to reduce this waste. Mm-hmm. Are there like roles that the government can play similar to that, or things that you would be helpful to your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think requiring these stores to partner with an organization like ours would be a really great move. We are seeing some movement within like the food scraps law that is being implemented now here in Portland.
Can you describe that?
Yeah. You have to, I can't remember if it's exactly like a certain weight, but you have to be correctly composting or doing something with your food scraps. You cannot be throwing them away if you're a grocery store or independent business or if you're a restaurant. So I'm not totally sure on like the full implementation, so I don't want to speak too much to it. But I know that it's something that they're that it's been in the works here in Portland for a while, and they're kind of starting to like look into like what implementation of that looks like. You know, are they auditing businesses? I'm not totally certain. But I think pushes like that are going to really make a huge impact into, you know, maybe they didn't even know that we existed and there was a place to take that food. You know, maybe they just thought composting or throwing it away was like kind of what they had to do. You know, there's a lot of misunderstanding around dates. Dates aren't federally regulated. That's why you see so many different dates between like Best Buy, Use By, Fresh Buy, like that sort of stuff. It's all different and all over the place because it's up to the person making that product's discretion to what they want to put on there. So, you know, these stores are like having to push stuff off their shelves and they aren't sure to where it needs to go. They have to throw it away. So it's really great for us to like, we'll take it all.
Fresh Buy is new to me. I hadn't heard that one yet.
I saw one this week that was like, will taste Best Buy. Like, okay, this is a new one. We're getting like more creative with how we're saying things. And, you know, it doesn't affect the safety of the item at all. The food item is completely safe. There's actually a really interesting app that I just found out about recently, and I'm telling everyone about it. But it's by the USDA, and it's called the Food Keeper app. And it has like anything and everything you could imagine on there. And it'll tell you, you know, if it's open and you put in your refrigerator, like how long it should last by. And you can like put a little date in there and it'll remind you like, hey, you opened your ketchup 3 years ago. It probably like it's probably getting to the point where maybe you should have ate it by now. So it's supposed to help reduce food waste and just help you learn a little bit more on like actually how safe items can stay.
Well, you touched on one of them, but one of the things I wanted to ask is, do you encounter misunderstandings that people have about urban gleaners or these issues that your work touches on?
Yeah, we definitely do. I think we're trying to change the narrative and like really educate on the type of food that we're giving out. Like, you know, we say this food was headed for a landfill, so people think trash or people think waste or garbage. Whereas like this food, I mean, and if anyone wants to come in and see our warehouse, we'd be happy to give you guys a tour and see, you know, the type of foods that we're taking in. It's fresh. It's amazing. Like we'll get in a box of lettuce that says, you know, it's Best Buy this day and everything. It's not even wilted. It's not wet or anything. Like, yes, vegetables and things like that do lose nutrients over time, but we're really everything we're getting is not in that category. And we're sorting through those things very meticulously all day long. That's what most of our community support associates are doing. Half their job is sorting through everything to make sure that everything we're sending out is fresh and delicious and nutritious and not gonna be past that line of, you know, a little bit too far gone. So yeah, it's just I think the reality of like, you know, we say like this 40% of food that's produced is wasted and, you know, all the resources that are entwined in that, like food, you know, it takes water, it takes land, it takes energy. And so if we're wasting 40% of that food, that's 40% of all these other resources that went into it. And that food is actually not waste. Like, obviously, yes, some of it is, but not the food that we're getting in.
Right. I mean, in my mind, I'm kind of likening it to when I worked in restaurants mm-hmm. and they're this coffee cake, we can't sell it tomorrow. Do you want to take it?
Yeah.
It's like, great, I'll take it. I get sick of the coffee cake.
Yeah.
It's still there. You know, we have to, what are we going to do with it kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. You know, day old breads, like that sort of thing. We get all that in and it's all great and fresh and fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you see as growth in kind of this next step? I mean, you are the executive director.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want Urban Gleaners to go?
Yeah, we have a lot of kind of a backlog of people who've reached out wanting to set up markets with us. We just don't have enough food to sustainably bring on more programming right now. So right now we're kind of delving into how do we get more food into Urban Gleaners so that we can set up more markets. You know, we think our markets are a pretty desirable style, that our food, people really, really like our food and want it. So we're trying to figure out more ways to get in more food. And right now that's kind of that farm program that I touched on earlier, is diving into that side of gleaning, which is new for us. But we're really, really excited.
There was another mention on your website that I wanted to touch on, which is these markets that you've created also focusing on food deserts. Can you discuss that part of it a little bit?
Yeah. I saw this thing that, so we have a market in Lentz Park, and recently the Walmart left in that neighborhood, and then Lentz Park or Lentz neighborhood became a food desert, which is like a really, really interesting thing because it's like so close to the city. You know, it's kind of like, I think of food deserts, I think of like more rural communities. We are trying to focus all of our markets in high areas of need so that we're filling that gap where an affordable grocery store may have left. I saw this really interesting take on it, which I really resonated with, because most of our sites are set up in schools. You know, you do, there are food deserts, but there aren't really school deserts. Like, there's a school in almost every community. And I think that having that community access point has been really, really successful for us. Setting up in these schools is like, you know, we're able to reach people where they're already going, and like setting up in community centers and parks, like we're reaching people where they're already going so they don't have to travel super far to go and access any food. So that's something that's like really important to us, that we're going to make sure that as we grow our markets that we're still focusing in those areas.
And are the school markets primarily directed at kids and parents?
Yeah. So it's pretty interesting, but Oregon has like one of the worst child hunger issues in the country. So that is how our mission originally was set up, was to feed children and their families. And so the schools are really great because we set up the markets either in the morning or in the afternoon. And so when their kids get dropped off, their parents or their guardians can go through and shop for whatever it is they need. At the end of the day, the same sort of thing, or the kids at the end of the day can kind of go through the lines themselves and get what they need for the week, which is really, really great.
Well, if our listeners are interested in learning more about Urban Gleaners, what is the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, well, they can go to our website, urbangleaners.org. We also have a lot of like fun events going on for Earth Month right now. On Sunday the 28th at Artifact, they're doing their like dollar flea on Sunday from 10 to noon. And every 100% of the proceeds are all going to Urban Gleaners, which is really exciting. We're also doing a month-long raffle with Evo. You can go to their Instagram or go to their Portland store, and you can enter the raffle. They're giving away like a cool little bike package for the month. And then this month, too, we also did an upcycled ice cream with salt and straw, and it's available now. It's really amazing. It's we gave them some bananas that were too brown for us to send out to the sites. So we gave these bananas to Salt and Straw, and they made this like delicious banana bread ice cream with like chocolate covered potato chips. So definitely check that out at your local Salt and Straw.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate the work that you do. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Nico Norden, the executive director of Urban Gleaners, a Portland area nonprofit connecting fresh, unsold food to people who need it. You've been listening to a special Earth Day program, Environmental Justice Changemakers Are Making It Happen. For the last hour and a half, I spoke to Oregon nonprofit leaders from across the environmental issue, from saving salmon and pollinator habitat to providing green job training for Black youth and reducing food waste. Folks across our state are putting in the work at the intersection of climate, food, justice, and opportunity. I want to thank all my guests for their time, Nico at Urban Gleaners, Jason from the Blueprint Foundation, Christina at Pollinator Project Rogue Valley, and Audie and Tim from the Wild Salmon Center. Music was The Custodian of Records by Philly Guts, courtesy of Free Music Archive. I'd also like to thank Matea Carlin and Reed Johnson for their help in putting this piece together. For KBOO Radio, I'm Althea Billings. Happy Earth Day.